You're listening to the GNU World Order, Season 12, Episode 43, for October 21st, 2018. Hey everyone, this is Klaatu, and I'm not really here. I'm actually at the All Things Open conference, the technical conference in Raleigh, North Carolina. So I'm recording this from New Zealand before I've even left. But that won't matter, because this episode has nothing to do with anything that is time-sensitive. And in fact, it's going to start out with a rather old email that I received now. I received this September 21st and have ignored it ever since. Not because I wanted to ignore it, but because it didn't quite fit in, and then into the, you know, the topics at hand. And then I when I went to record the next episode, I read this email again, and I thought, you know what, this is actually really, this isn't just an email, this is a whole line of thought of stuff that I'm very interested in. And it's a little bit of a rehash, I guess, in a way, to what I was speaking about Fossil and Git in the first place, but with a little bit more of a point to it. So here we go. This is from Jim, who runs the bikesatwork.com website and pedalpc.com. Really quite cool stuff that he talks about on the websites that he runs. You should go check them out. But anyway, he was saying in this email, I was listening to your recent podcast about Fossil and the difference between it and Git. I am by no means an expert in version control, but I believe one of the big differences between Git and some other version control systems like Fossil and Mercurial, another popular open source version control system written in Python, is that Git uses a staging area to mark files prior to a commit, while in Fossil and HG, which is the a short term for Mercurial HG, there is no staging area. In other words, when a file is added to a repository in Fossil, using Fossil add, it's now always tracked. All modified and tracked files are automatically included in the next commit. I think I prefer Fossil's way of doing this, as I always found the concept of a staging area a bit confusing anyway. It's more clear, in my humble opinion, actually he wrote IMO, IMHO, to simply commit all the files that have changed and not have to worry about which ones may have been missed on a commit. So this is, in itself, this is a great email because, first of all, I didn't know that Mercurial did it this way. I'm taking Jim at his word that it does it that way. And so I guess I didn't really realize that Git was unique in the way that it treated the files that you have added to a repository and then modified, and you know how you're then going to get them back to upstream. I didn't realize Git was the odd man out on that one. I just assumed, because as I've said very frequently, Git was my first version control system, and really, you could probably argue it's basically my only version control system. I mean, I am using Fossil on two different projects. But I mean, does that give me the right to say that I'm using that I've used several different, you know, I'm messing around with Fossil. I'm toying with it. I'm not really using it probably. Although actually, you know, the 3 hours I've spent looking up how to do something in Fossil, yeah, maybe that does give me some credit. But anyway, up until very recently, Git was all I knew anyway. So I had no idea that this was a unique concept. Staging area made perfect sense to me. And I gotta say, now that I know that Fossil does it a different way, and apparently Mercurial does it a different way, I gotta say it is a little bit weird, the staging area concept. I mean, you've got a branch that you've created as your workspace. You've made changes to files. Why would you then stage the files before committing? Like, why isn't that? It feels like the staging area is redundant to the concept of a branch that you've made as your as the area where you are going to work, as your workspace. So that, yeah, it does seem a bit odd. If anything, I would think that the staging area would be optional. And in fact, if you really think about it, you've got in the Git system, you've got your, you know, you've got the repository, right? Okay. So then from the repository, you create a branch which represents your workspace. That's where you're going to do all of your sandboxy types of changes that could go horribly wrong. And so you don't want them to go straight into the master branch, possibly. You want this to be a special area where you can mess around. Okay, so you've got your branch. And then in order to get them committed, you have to then put them into this thing called the staging area with the command of git add. And that's even, you know, that's not if you've created a new file, that's just if you've modified something. And then optionally, you can stash these changes with git stash, which pushes all of your changes to this pretend area called the stash. It's sort of like this, you know, it offloads everything into stash. And now you've got your branch again, and you've added stuff to your staging area, but you've stashed it, so you kind of shelved all of that stuff. So you're just back in your branch, which is not your master branch. So you're still in your sandbox, but for some reason your sandbox has this one area for staging that has been removed from the sandbox and put in a stash. So I mean, there's more or less, by my estimation, there are three things that are kind of functioning the same way. Where are your changes today? Oh, they're in my branch. Are you sure? Oh no, sorry. They're in my branch, but I put them in the staging area. I don't see them there. Oh, sorry. I stashed them. That's a lot of different places to have things. Now, that said, they work for me. You know, I mean, I've got a branch. I've earmarked the things that feel they're good. These are good changes. So when I do a commit, make sure that these changes are committed. But that other change in that other file that I didn't add to my staging area, just leave it in my branch. We'll just keep it there for now. So there's a meta level to what a branch is. And that is the stuff that you've committed that goes upstream for merging. And you've got your other stuff in your branch that isn't quite ready for merging. So that, to me, that does make sense. Now that I've said, oh, there seems to be a lot of redundancy there, I still get it. It still makes sense to me. And the stash, I mean, the stash, I don't think is meant. It's more of an exception than part of your workflow. That's the thing that you do when you realize, oh my gosh, I have to do something drastic, but I don't want to lose these changes. So I mean, why wouldn't you just use another branch? I don't know. I've used stash before. I've used it with great success. And as I said, I've never questioned why I've done these things, because that was all I knew. And in fact, if you sat me down in Fossil today, I would, you know, and said, hey, set some work, do the thing in Fossil that you have to do to set work aside, I would be trying to duplicate Fossil stash. I would try to make that a thing. I don't know if it's a thing, I haven't looked, but that would be the mindset that I approach would be based on that Git workflow. I wouldn't think around how to do a stash-like action. I would simply try to duplicate it, and I would probably get very frustrated when all my internet searches came up with, you know, for, you know, Git stash in Fossil or whatever. They probably wouldn't even know what I was asking, I'm imagining, and that would be frustrating. And as I said in the episode where I was talking about this in the first place, I feel like that's a lot of times the barrier to learning something new is your vocabulary is wrong, or the way that your thinking is wrong, and that this would be probably a great example of that. I mean, I don't know for sure because I haven't actually tried it, but I've definitely tried other things with Fossil. I mean, trying to find the Fossil staging area took me forever to figure that out, because it was just one of those things that no matter how much I searched on the internet for these phrases that I thought surely other people have searched for this combination of phraseology, surely this would be something in an FAQ somewhere, but it just wasn't. There was no, I just kind of eventually caught on that there was no such thing as a staging area in Fossil, and that you don't have to keep adding your changes in Fossil. They're just, that's why they're there. They're in your repository. They're being tracked. If you change them, part of the function of a version control system is to record those changes. It makes sense. I get it. I get both sides of the story. I get it. Both sides of that, this theory, or of this, the way of doing things, I totally see both have really, really good rationale behind them. But there's that big gap of comprehension that you have to get around in order to use one from the other. And that's really difficult to do. And hey, that's a great idea for a segment. So let's go get a cup of coffee, frankly, because I'm out and I actually do need to go get a cup of coffee. And then we'll talk about learning new software. I have three tips on how to learn new stuff. Probably doesn't even have to apply to software. I just want to talk about learning and the process of learning and some of the ways that people do and don't go about it, and some of the ways that might work for you, might work for me, might not, but we'll talk about it. So go get yourself a cup of coffee. Come back right afterwards. Back. I have my coffee. I'm quite happy to have coffee. But you know what I'm really thinking about now, or that I got started thinking about while I was making myself coffee, was tea, which, as you probably know if you've heard this show, I don't really drink a whole lot of tea, but I do like a good iced tea. Now, if you're not from America, you probably don't really drink iced tea. It doesn't seem to be a thing. At least here in New Zealand, no one would think to have iced tea. No one even has ice here in New Zealand. People don't really do ice outside of America, from what I can tell, or at least here in New Zealand. But I've heard it's common elsewhere to not have ice. So here in New Zealand, they do drink a lot of hot tea, but they wouldn't ever think to drink cold tea. That's just weird to them. But I like to make sun tea, which is where you take a bottle. I use a jar, really, but you can, you know, use whatever you got on hand. You fill it with water, put some tea bags into it, close it, and set it outside in your lawn, in your garden, as they say here in New Zealand. And the sun beats down on it and brews it slow. It's a slow brew over the course of the day. And then you bring it inside around dinner time, put some ice cubes in a glass, which I don't have. I don't have either a glass or ice cubes. I use, again, a jar. And I don't have ice cubes, so I just put it in the refrigerator and then wait for it to get cold. And then I have tea. Cold tea, and it's delicious. It's amazing. If you've never had iced tea, like actual sun tea, you should try this. It's really, really good. And I think most Americans probably have done this, but I feel like people outside of America that might not be a thing. I know people get really confused at me when I have a jar of tea slowly brewing outside in my garden every day, or every week, rather. But anyway, I got to thinking about tea, and specifically, I was thinking about sweet tea, which is a thing that, again, probably people outside of America don't even know that this is a thing. I mean, if you even knew that iced tea was a thing, which maybe you did, maybe you knew about Lipton iced tea or something, but you may not know this. So in the south part of America, not just like the south half, like you have to kind of get really south. So you have to go past Maryland, past Virginia, and once you start getting into the Carolinas and into Georgia and probably some other states, there's this very unique tradition, really. I hesitate to even call it a tradition because that makes it almost seem like there's an awareness of it. I don't even know if there's, like, it's just an innate part of their culture, and it's very unique to this region, to these regions. That when you say you want some iced tea, the way that they make it is they do the iced tea process that I've just described, the sun tea thing where they put it outside, but they make it with, or maybe they don't, maybe they cook it on the stove, but they make it with just heaps and heaps of sugar. So you get this glass of tea, and it is like, I don't even know how to describe it. I guess it's almost like drinking golden syrup. If you've ever had syrup, just sweet, you know, liquid. That's kind of what drinking this stuff is like. It's a little bit more watered down, you know, a little bit more less viscous than golden syrup. But it is just super sweet, and it tastes like tea instead of golden syrup or molasses or whatever. You know, it's tea. So it's really crazy. You drink it. It for me, it barely quenches the thirst because there's so much sugar in it. I don't think I've ever put lemon in it. I think they deliver it sometimes with lemon, a slice of lemon, but I don't think I do that. In real life, I do, but in the South, I don't, because there's just so much sugar, and I feel like squeezing lemon into that would just, I guess, turn it into an Arnold Palmer or a lemonade or something. So I do none of these things, but in the South, whenever I am in the South, as I am now, well, not really, but as I've said, I'm recording this in advance. When you're hearing this, I will be in the South of America, of the U.S., of the USA. And so I will probably be drinking a lot of sweet tea because it's the only time I can get it. I can't even say that I like it that much. And yet when I'm there, I just feel such a compulsion to have sweet tea because I know that it's a thing there. It's such a unique and weird thing. I have to partake. I've got to get sweet tea. So every time I go out for a meal in the South, in America, I always get sweet tea at every meal because I'll only get to have it, you know, for those 4 or 5 days that I'm there. And then I won't have it for another year or two or whatever. I mean, at this point it'll be 2 years since I've had it. So it's not something that I miss, but when I'm there, I am always sure to have some sweet tea. And if you're there for any reason, if you're in the South of America, of the USA, I should say, I keep saying America, and I'm hyper aware now that America isn't just North America because people point that out to me frequently. But if you grow up in North America, you just call it America. But people here in New Zealand, for instance, there are lots of people from America, or from the Americas, I should say. And so if you say, oh, I'm from America, they will think, well, what does that mean? From North America? From North America, Canada? From the U.S.? From any number of countries in South America? Where are you from? So, yeah, the U.S. But if you're ever there, be sure to check out the sweet tea. You may hate it, but at least you will have experienced it. Okay, so now I want to talk about the thing that I said I was going to talk about, which is learning. Learning is important, as you probably know. It's something that I think about a lot. It's something that I try to encourage and I try to facilitate. I've been a paid teacher before in several different capacities, both as just a freelance, hey, come over to my place and teach me this thing, as well as here's a building that is a school, and now you will teach people things on a regular classroom basis. So I've done lots of learning types of things, and I'll admit that I'm not all that learned myself. I never finished any schooling really to speak of, and I don't have any qualifications at all. I've never studied learning, you know, like the process of learning or anything like that. But I do feel like my experience with teaching has given me some kind of view of the learning process. And this Fossil and Git email from Jim kind of made me think about some of that stuff. And generally, the idea that I have grown up, as it were, not since childhood, obviously, but I mean, like, in terms of my version control experience has been Git exclusively, and now I'm learning Fossil. It has, as I've said in the previous episode on the topic, given me a much needed view from the other side, the side of, oh my gosh, I have to learn something new, and I have all this prior experience with something completely different. How do I do that? And that's the question, isn't it? Especially for us computer folk, because people are constantly telling us, no, I want an open source solution for such and such. Well, try this. Oh my gosh, it's too different. I can't handle it. I'm going back to the other thing. I want to try Linux. Okay, here. Oh my gosh, it's too different. I can't handle it. I'm going to go back to Windows or whatever. So it happens all the time. We hear about these learning problems a lot. And while it's not within our power to fix other people, we certainly can analyze how that affects us and maybe empathize with people such that we can possibly assist others in figuring new things out that maybe maybe it's difficult to figure something out. So the first thing that I thought of, and this isn't just based on me and Fossil and Git. This is also actually, and I'll be using a couple of different examples, but Scribus, for instance, has helped me understand how people don't understand how to learn something new because of some recent experiences with Scribus. So this is, I'm trying to make this broad, in other words. So first of all, first thing that I thought of, the zeroth point, if you want to learn something new, whether it's a GUI application like Scribus, or a command like Fossil or Git, or a programming language like Lua or Guile or Python. Use something for its unintended use. That sounds a little bit strange, but that's what I want to pitch to you as a learner. Now, this isn't, my next point is going to be basically the exact opposite of this, but one of the ways to approach something is to learn, is to use it for its unintended use, meaning you can sit down and look at something and kind of figure out what it's meant to be used for. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to figure that out for a programming language, which in theory is multi-purpose, right? There's no intended use for a programming language aside from programming a computer. But certainly very few programming languages say, okay, this is a programming language exclusively for doing these kinds of programs. I mean, some of them supposedly specialize in some area of analytics, and other things like a scripting front end for, let's say, Image Magic certainly has a very specific use, and it may be difficult to use it for an unintended use. But when possible, sometimes it is interesting to use something for its unintended use as a way to learn what you can do with that thing, or maybe learn what you can't do with that thing, which is a frustrating way to go about learning. But if you're in it just for the learning part of it, so if you're okay with the fact that, okay, I have to learn this new thing, then sometimes taking something at a different angle than the way that even its own tutorial authors think that you ought to take it can be very enlightening. So, for instance, if you are learning Perl, a lot of the things that you will find online have the assumption that you are learning Perl in order to parse text. That's their assumption. They want you to cut text up. That's what they want you to do. They want you to learn regex. They want you to do these specific things with Perl. Now, if that's what you want to do with Perl, then great. But if it's not, or maybe it is, but you're finding it a little bit dizzying, all of this straight up, just here's regex, read it and learn it, and then start using Perl, maybe that's not effective for you. So if you use it in a different way, you may learn the stuff that you need to learn in a way that you yourself can better understand. So a really good example of this is Python, for instance. Teaching Python to 11-year-olds, I very frequently find myself teaching them how to make games, for instance, which, I mean, you can't argue Python's not intended for games. I mean, obviously it is. And like I say, with programming languages, the intended slash unintended part of this is probably not the best terminology. But it's terminology that I'll stick with for now. Certainly, if you go to a lot of Python learning sites, one of the things that they will push right away are some of those really basic Python functions, like cutting up strings, or finding substrings within strings, or doing maths. Stuff that yes, it is important to know that stuff, but for a lot of people, that in itself is not an effective lesson in what a programming language is. Taking a programming language to someone and saying, here's how to do basic calculator functions in a terminal on your computer. That's not an effective way, possibly, to teach people. Or here's this programming language. With it, you can echo hello world, but use a function to cut it up such that you just get hello after you've said hello world. You know, it's just, okay, how does this get me from typing in stuff to a computer to making an application appear on my screen? So the one of the things that I do when teaching Python to people is I do a really basic dice rolling app. Super simple, right? But at least it's something that they can relate to. Everyone knows how to roll a die. So getting a computer to produce a random number, that's a good lesson. Do I tell them about the Python random number function? No, I don't. So I get them to think about other things. Okay, I want you to do a dice rolling app. It'll be really simple. It'll be one command. You tell it to roll some die. Okay, here's how can you get a random number out of a computer? And that sets them off on a very interesting trajectory because they've probably never thought of how to get a random number from a computer before. And I've not told them about the random number function of Python, so Now they have to think about it. And I ask them, well, look around you in the real world. Where could you get a number? How could you just generate a random number in the real world? And then they start thinking about that. That's actually not that easy either. How do you get a random number in the real world? I've talked about this before. Or no, on Hacker Public Radio, I've talked about this. So it's a complex problem. And then they have to think about, well, there's a clock in the room, because they're usually in a classroom. There's a clock. We could just look up at the clock at random intervals, and we get a different number each time. Okay, but it's a little bit predictable, so how could we change that? And they have to come up with ways. Well, maybe we could ask the person, the user, for a number, and then we could take the number on the clock, and then we could do some math against the number that we've asked the person for and the number on the clock. So we've got basically two seeds, and then we come up with some other result from that. Or maybe they come up with, you know, we could ask the person for the name of an animal, and however many letters we get from whatever the user has typed, we'll take that as their, you know, so we're tricking them into choosing a number by asking them for something that seems innocuous. And then we can use a timestamp plus that and come up with some, you know, whatever. So the point being, this very simple activity has people discovering other parts of the language. So instead of just saying, okay, we're going to do a dice app, here's the random number generator in Python, here's how you start it, here's how you call it, okay, we're done. And now what have you learned? Not a whole lot. You've learned about one function in Python, and you don't even know what a function is yet. But if you're thinking about, okay, well, now I need to do this, how can I do that? Oh, well, there is a function called date time, and you can get the timestamp here, but this is a big number, so what do we do with all those numbers? Well, we could cut it down, so now you're learning how to get a sub, you know, cutting up strings and cutting up numbers, or maybe doing math on numbers, and you're learning a lot of the same things, but in a very, very different way. So using something for its unintended use is often a great way to learn about all the different features that something has that might be almost too overwhelming for you to learn otherwise. Another great example of this actually is Scribus. Scribus is pretty specifically it's a desktop publishing application. It's a layout application. It isn't meant for what most people would think of, I guess, as graphic design. You wouldn't go into Scribus necessarily and draw an image. That would not be the optimal tool for that. But when you want to put that image and some text on a page together, you very well could use Scribus for that. Now, what if instead of doing that with Scribus, you decided to open up Scribus and write a business letter in it? Now, that arguably is not what Scribus is for. I mean, you could probably argue, well, it's not unintended. It's just that they would, you know, normal people would open up a word processor to do a letter, and they would not use Scribus for that. So if you use Scribus for just generating just a simple text object like a business letter, then you're kind of not using it correctly. But you'll learn a heck of a lot about its text tool, which I myself just learned new stuff about Scribus styles the other day, because I've used Scribus 1,000 times, love it, swear by it. Never had the occasion to use a numbered list in Scribus. There's not a button for that. You have to make a style just to have a numbered list, because once again, they don't actually intend for you to do complex, you know, like business outlines or whatever in Scribus. That's not what I was doing, but I was doing something that needed a numbered list, and so you had to learn about that. So yeah, unintended use sometimes can be very, very educational, and it kind of gets you out of the thought process that you would usually come to that application with, which again, if I'm using Fossil and in the back of my head is all the stuff that I know about Git, then the blocker isn't Fossil, the blocker is Git. And so using Fossil in some way different than how I would normally use Git is a huge thing, because that way it breaks the analogy that doesn't really exist, you know, it breaks those connections that I'm trying to force into the application. This is how you do this on Fossil. Well, forget about it. There is no analogy to that. There's no analog to that Git thing that you're trying to do in Fossil. So if you use it in a way that you have never used Git this way before, so you have no expectations on how Fossil will handle it, makes it a lot easier. So Number one, the point one, is use something for its intended use. That seems really, really obvious, but I wanted to throw it in there because saying to use something for its unintended use is, it's borderline bad advice, right? I get really annoyed when people come to some application and get angry at that application because they're trying to make it into something that's just not what that application is. And I've gotten lots of questions about, you know, why doesn't this do that? It's like, why would it? That's not what you're using it wrong. You're not, this is not what it's for. So there is a fine line between using something for its unintended use and doing the same thing because you want to learn more about it. And you have to, you do have to differentiate those two things. So if you're looking at an application as a solution for some problem, then make sure that your problem aligns with what that application delivers. So in other words, the zeroth point to use something for its unintended use was a learning tip only. The successful side of adopting an application is to make sure that you're looking at the right application. And I've kind of talked about that before in the previous episode where I was talking about analyzing applications for whether you're going to use them or not. But I guess you could go further and say that in order to find an application that you want to use and that you want to spend time learning, I think you have to you do want to verify that it does what you think it's going to do. And that can be difficult. That can be difficult to analyze. Something like Fossil and Git, it's pretty easy because it's kind of yet general knowledge. Yes, Fossil can do everything that Git does. Git does what Fossil does. It's going to get the same result, and it's pretty widely recognized that they are two means toward the same end. Whereas I feel like on other applications where definitions are a little bit fuzzier, it can be a lot harder to decide really. Well, is this the kind of application that I think it is, or is this not the right tool for the job? I'll use a fairly obscure example for this. So musical scoring is a funny business, musical scoring. And there are, even out there in the non-open source world, there are lots of different solutions to that end. And many of them approach it in a different way. Some of them really, really strive to score music as you play it, and then allow you to modify it to be more human readable, because it's usually a little bit too precise when automatically scoring things. Others don't really strive for that and prefer to just be really musical typesetters. And still others kind of, they try to straddle the line. So it can be difficult sometimes to analyze a scoring program and just determine kind of like what its style is. How does it approach this problem? Not from a technical standpoint, or rather not from a user standpoint, but from a technical standpoint, like from a very sort of, well, what are you offering me here? Are you going to try to do the thinking for me, or are you going to just sit back and be a typewriter, except with musical notes rather than English letters and numbers? Kind of something that you have to almost try in order to, you have to kind of experience it to know whether it suits your needs. So it can be difficult to understand what the intended use is. And I think your best way of knowing that really is research. Find out what other people have used this application for, look at the results, see if that's what you, if it's going to do what you think it's going to do. Another really great example of that, I think, would be Inkscape versus Scribus. A lot of people new to graphic design they'll discover the program that is for graphic design, and because those are usually pretty flexible applications, they start using that for everything. It's the old, when everything looks like a nail, everything's a hammer or whatever. They go with it, and then you try to get them into something like Scribus, which is a little bit more focused on page layout, and they just don't understand why they would bother. They're just thinking, well, why would I use all of the features that you're showing me here are available to me over in my drawing application. So why would I learn the other application? It's a really hard sell. It's really funny usually to see students sort of justify why they don't need to know the layout program because they already have the vector drawing application and it has everything that they need over there. And it, you know, and it's, you can try to convince them, but until they see it themselves, they don't get it. And then eventually when you start bringing in lots of different resolution images and hundreds of pages rather than just one or five or 10 different page, different master page layouts, you know, then it's like, oh, okay, now I get it. Why didn't you say so? I did say so. So yeah, there are intended uses. There are best cases for certain applications, and discovering what those are, it's important. Okay, so the second point is, while learning an application or a language or whatever, identify things that slow you down as you work, and then abandon them. This is one method. It kind of depends on your style and what you're doing, but I'm proposing one way to do this would be, yeah, to abandon the things that are slowing you down. So you're trying to figure something out, can't figure it out. Walk away from it, strive to learn two alternative ways to accomplish what you were trying to do. This is not always possible, obviously, but especially since this is just for learning, I find a lot of times that if I can't figure something out, then I give up on it. And I'm very specifically talking about things that I can't figure out how to do in one application or one language that I have uncovered because of my expectations of another. So for instance, when doing Fossil and realizing that I could not figure out exactly how to definitely get a file that has been changed into my staging area, which as it turns out didn't exist, I just kind of, what I would do is I just kept adding the files. Even if it said that it was just modified and it didn't have the little add flag by it, I just thought, well, I'm gonna add it just in case that's a step that I do have to do. Because nothing seems to be breaking, but I'm just gonna do that and keep committing. Add, commit, even, and then eventually I researched it and discovered that I didn't have to add, that they were already added because I had changed them. And that was by virtue of the fact that I had changed it, it was being tracked. So we're good. But I didn't stop my work in order to discover the correct method to do this. I just kept doing it because everything seemed to be working. In Scribus, for instance, rotating an image, or even honestly, adding an image. A lot of people starting out with Scribus, if they've never used a layout program before, it's a complete mystery to them. How do I add an image? Well, here's an image icon, a box. I click that. I don't get a dialog box. Okay, I click it and draw a square. Okay, I get an empty square. So there's no image inside of there. How do I get an image in there? So just, you know, whatever you're expecting, walk away from that and try something different. Drag and drop from your file manager. It actually works. Go figure. Right-clicking, get image. It works. So you'll find new ways to do something if you stop trying to ham-fist the way that you think it's supposed to be done. Rotating an image in Scribus. A lot of people coming to Scribus and just based on other applications, like Inkscape, for instance, there's an image on your screen. How do you rotate it? You want to just rotate it 45 degrees. That's all you want to do. You roll over the nodes on the corners. It doesn't change your cursor at all. It turns out there's a button for rotating, and that'll work. But you could also have found the palette with the properties of that item and rotated it by the numbers, typing in numbers to the rotate box. So there are, there are very, very frequently, often, alternate ways to accomplish the thing that you think should be done this way. And I think that's what really slows us down a lot of times. It's our previous experience. We believe that if we see an image on the screen with nodes around its bounding box, we should be able to roll over those nodes and press some modifier key, maybe shift or control or something, to get a different kind of cursor and then rotate that thing. But if you forget if you force yourself to abandon the idea that that is how it should be done, and oh my gosh, how stupid is it that it's not done this way in this application? I can't even be bothered to use this application, it's so dumb. Well, just slow down, stop, forget what you think ought to happen and find out a different way to make to get to the same point. Okay, third point is to initially focus on the fun and the easy stuff. So again, this is very much all assuming that you're approaching something very specifically to learn that thing. So this is not, it's crunch time, someone dropped this new application in my lap, oh my gosh, I have to make this thing happen. But it's you sitting down to learn an application. And I would say a great way to learn is to focus on the fun and the easy stuff. Again, you may be using this application for its unintended use, but if you've opened it and you've discovered some interesting tricks in the application that are fun to use and are producing some kind of result, I say go for it. Follow that path. Because a lot of times as you focus on fun and easy and intuitive stuff, you kind of knock all that stuff out of the way and you start digging deeper into the application and discover the more the complexer stuff. And maybe that complex stuff, maybe that'll take you a little bit of research to figure out how to make it work. And that's okay. Especially since focusing on the fun and the easy stuff often keeps you in that application. And sometimes that's really important when learning a new application. Maybe you're not really super familiar with how that application works, but man, can you draw a cube and then extrude a couple of parts of it? And you figured out how to switch modes to edit mode, and now you can grab corners of the cube and you're stretching it out and you're treating this 3D gray cube like putty, and that's kind of fun. And then eventually you'll discover something different. You know, you'll understand, oh my gosh, if I put a keyframe here and then advance a little bit in my timeline and pull the corner out and put a new keyframe there, I've just made an animation of this cube expanding on one corner or whatever. So focusing on stuff that you can just kind of figure out, and then letting the harder stuff come to you, because at some point, all that fun and easy stuff that you figured out isn't going to be enough. You're going to want to do more. And that's where you'll find that more complex stuff. Now, this is the complete flip opposite of what we do when we have to learn something. You know, when someone drops something into our lap and says, we need you to design this layout for this the ad for the magazine, but we need you to do it on this application. Good luck. And then you're taking your previous experience and trying to force it onto this new application, because you have a very specific goal. And so you just need to know where the buttons are and what the settings are in this application to make it give you the same thing that other application would have given you. And that's a horrible way to learn things, and I don't think anyone would really necessarily argue with that. It's just one of those things that sometimes that's how it is. Sometimes we get something dropped in our lap and we just have to learn it from advanced process down to the simple stuff. I'm saying that if you have the luxury of focusing on the simple stuff and then building your way up to the advanced stuff, that's great. Take it. And then my final tip, I think it's number four, so it's the fifth tip here, is to eventually take time to research the stuff that you couldn't figure out. I think sometimes that's a step that we forget. Once you find the workaround, a lot of time that workaround becomes your permanent solution, and that's not always the best way to use an application. It's not always the most efficient way, certainly. So if you're using an application, you've learned a lot about it, you've gotten to a pretty good place with it, you know, take an afternoon where you've even jotted down problems. That's what I used to do at my old job, very old job. I kept a legal pad next to my keyboard on my desk, and I would literally, when I came up against something that I did not know how to do, I would jot it down. And then later that week or later in the day or whatever, I would go back to that thing and figure it out. Even if I've already worked around the issue, I'll go back to that thing and figure out how to do it. And then if it's something that I can write down I had another page, like a cheat sheet, I would write that down. Or I would just remember that thing was possible. So I might not even remember how to do it, but I know that I've solved it. And the next time I come up against it, I will know, oh wait, I've solved that before. And you can kind of rediscover it, I think, easier once you've already done it once. So that's always an important one, I think, is that if you are thinking to yourself, all right, I'll just use this workaround, don't let that become your permanent solution. Go back, follow it up, and find out the right way. Or if it's a programming language, there might not be a right way, but at least get a consensus from the community on what the generally accepted way to do something happens to be. That's it. Those were my thoughts, my initial thoughts on how to effectively learn new applications. Now, I realize that situations change. Sometimes you're pressed for time. You're under a lot of pressure. You don't have the luxury to just sort of sail into an application leisurely and learn how to use it over the course of a couple of months. And that's a problem, and it's a real problem. And unfortunately, there's no shortcut around that. If you have to learn something quickly, you have to learn something quickly. And there's not really a great way, you know, that I know of to get around that block. I mean, you just have to sit there and hammer away at it until it works. Although I will say, actually, I guess one small thing that I've noticed about that sort of thing is when trying to learn something quickly, I find myself, and this may just be me, I don't know, but for me, a lot of times the biggest block to getting around a problem is just my insistence that there is a better way to do something. And I get very, very annoyed, especially when under pressure to learn something. I get very annoyed when something is clearly not the best way to, not the most efficient way to an end. And I think I probably sometimes slow myself down because I think, you know what, this just shouldn't, why am I even bothering? Why am I giving this solution the honor of learning it? Because there's obviously a better way to do it. And that sometimes slows me down, which is, I mean, it's fine if I have the luxury to reject an entire philosophy of accomplishing a goal. But if I'm being paid to do something and the tool that I have available is this thing that they've paid me to use, you know, then eventually you just have to get over it and just say, okay, well, I know that there's a better way to do it, but this is the tool that I have been told to use. And so I'm going to learn the slow way, the inefficient way, the dumb way, even if it hurts to have to do it this way. So yeah, I get that. And I think that the healthiest thing in those cases is to simply look at something as if though it was a different process. And just keep in mind that it is a different process. It may not, in your eyes, render the same result. And that's okay. You're not building the same thing. You're building, you know, you have to look at the tool as part of the finished product and just agree that this is how this product looks when created with this tool. I think that's probably underselling a lot of things. It's kind of undermining the way that you learn. And I've seen people do that with open source stuff, and it really, really bugs me. Where they'll you know, someone will challenge them, which is a horrible idea, but challenge them to use this application instead of that application. You know, so if they know Photoshop like the back of their hand, and someone says, what you should do is use GIMP, and I challenge you, and you can make the same pictures, you know. So they'll sit down and they'll spend like a weekend trying to figure this stuff out, trying to superimpose their previous knowledge onto this other thing. And then in the end, of course, they just figure, well, you know what, screw it. This is the photograph produced in this application instead of the one that I knew. And that's what you get. And that's, this photograph is now bound inextricably from the tool that created it, or from the tool that edited it. But in order to get past something, you know, especially in a paid gig, sometimes you just have to kind of do that. You just think, okay, this is what I could produce with this tool, given this deadline. But that's a different scenario. So hopefully learning something new is a lot more leisurely for you. You're not being forced to learn something. I think that's the optimal, probably, way to use it to learn stuff, is at your own pace. So hopefully these tips or observations, anyway, have at least inspired some observations of your own on how you learn stuff, whether you're learning new stuff. I know that probably most listeners of this show probably enjoy learning new stuff, but not necessarily all of us. For some, it's a chore, you know, and it kind of depends on what it is too, right? I mean, I certainly enjoy learning certain things more than others. So being able to look at the process that we use for learning stuff that we enjoy can often help us learn stuff that we don't necessarily love, kind of make it a little bit easier on us to accept our lot in life, that we have to learn this new thing for this job or whatever. It's not that bad, usually, especially if you keep those principles in mind about good learning practices. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go off to the conference now, probably. I imagine that's what I'll be doing right now, and I'll talk to you later. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order Ogcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually, in channels such as Ogcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Vitamin C food every day.